You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Washington Post released a poll in late January in which a quarter of all Americans, including 35% of Democrats, 40% of Democratic women, and 43% of Democrats under the age of 50, said they plan to be more politically active this year. And for many, it will be their first time. Joining us now is Eric Liu, the founder and CEO of Citizen University and executive director of the Aspen Institute Citizenship and American Identity Program. He's drawn on years of practicing and teaching civic engagement for his latest book, You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased it has brought Eric Liu to our show. Welcome.
Leonard, it's great to be back with you.
Have you been surprised by the level of activism since President Trump was elected?
Pleasantly surprised. I mean, I think what is remarkable is that we are seeing a civic surge of participation and engagement and learning really not seen in over half a century in this country right now. And a lot of that is in resistance to the Trump agenda, certainly from people who identify as left, but as much, a lot of activity is coming and emerging from the libertarian right, from reform conservatives. I think across the board right now, people are awakening to the cost of not paying attention and the cost of sitting on the sidelines.
At a recent Aspen Institute Festival of Ideas, you were on a panel that discussed why the 2016 election is teaching us about a changing America. What were some of the things that came up?
Well, I think one of the most basic things that this election taught us is that you can't get away with four decades of compounding inequality, four decades of widening polarization, four decades of a fraying of the social fabric without there being a great pushback. And the 2016 election season, whether it was coming from the left in the form of the Bernie Sanders campaign or from either the right or disaffected independents in the case of the Trump train, you had a lot of people who had previously been checked out or disengaged deciding this was their moment, actually, to put their muscle behind change. And that, to me, was a remarkable shift and one that, for all the turmoil that it has created, still I actually view optimistically because it's a sign of our body politics capacity for resilience.
Some of the things that came up were millennial distaste for the duopoly of party politics.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that distaste is going to grow, I imagine, based on what we've been seeing, but also anti-establishment anger, white anxiety, also an emerging electorate of color. But during this election, didn't African Americans vote in smaller numbers than in previous elections?
Compared to the elections when President Obama was at the top of the ballot, yes. I think there are a lot of ways to slice the electorate and the results of the election to feed different narratives, but there's no question that the reason why Donald Trump is president is that millions of people who were angry, disillusioned, alienated, disaffected, actually decided not to throw away their power anymore, but in fact to apply it, to give it to this candidate and to circulate it in a way that actually would give them voice. And that is the big change. Did he win the majority of the popular vote? No, but he had enough people show up in enough places that it changed the game fundamentally.
You write about several movements that were gaining traction and having an impact even before the 2016 presidential election. The Tea Party, obviously, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, the Dreamers Immigrant Rights Movement, the battles against the Keystone Pipeline and for marriage equality, the fight for $15. Have all of these movements become somewhat abated in the wake of the election?
Oh, no. All these movements which preceded the election, which helped feed the election, are now, I think, in even fuller flower post-election. And some listeners may think, well, what are you doing lumping into one list Black Lives Matter and the Tea Party or, you know, Trump people and $15 now? And the answer is that all of these movements, whatever their disparate partisan and ideological stances might be, are part of this general stance that's emerging in the country that's against monopoly, against concentrated power, against the people who rig the game. And that game can be the game of criminal justice and incarceration, or that game can be money in politics. But whatever it is, you have this surge of people who are saying, we want to bust these monopolies.
You open your book with mention of the fact that this is not confined to the United States. We It's all over the world. The Arab Spring, the Orange Revolution, the Maidan protests, the Green Revolution, the Cedar Revolution, the Indignados, the Umbrella Revolution, Brexit, anti-government protests in Poland, South Korea, Ethiopia, Hungary, Thailand, Brazil. Is there one thread that runs through all of that activism?
Well, I think the in many of these movements, there is populism and sometimes virulently racialist nationalism. But I think more even more deeply, what runs through all these movements, again, is the sense that people are reclaiming their ability to make others do what they would like them to do, which is my very definition of power in civic life, right? I think so many people around the world, during this crunch of globalization and during this period where the social fabric has been pulled apart, have come to believe in a story that says the system is so broken, there's no point in me getting involved. And they came to realize over the last few years that that story is too self-fulfilling, a defeatist story, and that if they actually change the story and say, you know what, if I organize with somebody else, if I show up with somebody else and show power of numbers, power of voice, power of money, power of social norms, I can fundamentally change the story here.
Well, but many of those actions that I listed have led to crackdowns.
Sure.
Suppression, even violence against the people involved. So how do activists know if they are making a difference?
How do the people who led the Montgomery bus boycott know what it would lead to 9 years later? There were crackdowns after that. There were not only by law enforcement, but again, just through social norms in the South. At any given moment, any given movement may seem like it is about to falter. But if you take the longer view and you think about any social change, particularly in the United States, that's worth claiming. Suffrage, abolition, marriage equality. These were not things that unfolded in one election cycle, much less in one Twitter cycle. These are things that took, in many cases, decades to unfold with lots of advances and retreats and setbacks.
The ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, was originally proposed at the beginning of the 20th century. Then it was shot down kind of in two-thirds into that century. And now people are talking about reviving it. But in this political climate?
Sure. Why not? I mean, I think the idea that this political climate should box our sense of what's possible is precisely what people in power count on, right? I think one of there are three fundamental laws of power that I write about in this book, Leonard. And number one is that it tends to concentrate and compound into monopolies. Number two is that it tends to justify itself through ideology and narrative and so forth. And the only thing that saves us from the doom loop of laws number one and two is law number three, which is that power is in fact infinite, that you can generate it out of thin air simply by organizing, right? And if it weren't for law number three, which doesn't say, by the way, that we are all equally powerful, it simply says that, Leonard, if you're ticked off about something, if you've been ticked off for decades about something, all it takes is for you to invite one other human into the work of cooperatively planning and organizing some kind of action here, and you've begun out of thin air to generate new power that did not exist in the civic system. And we're seeing that happen at scale in beautifully uncoordinated ways, whether it's women's marches, whether it's the Indivisible Movement throughout the United States right now, where people are realizing their capacity to exercise this third law of infinite power.
But those three laws can also create a power cycle. How do you bust up a power cycle?
Look, all of politics is a game of infinite repeat play. There are no – we are seeing right now when different pillars of the New Deal and Great Society are being chopped at from the base that no victory in politics is permanent. No policy achievement lasts forever. This is a game of perpetual push and pull. And the work of being engaged as a citizen – and by the way, I don't mean – as a person with the documents under the immigration and naturalization laws, I mean as a contributor to the body, as a participant in civic life, what it means to be a citizen is to be not just an interested bystander, but to be literate, to be fluent in how to read and write power, how to read how a situation came to be, and how to think about using the power of ideas, the power of other people, the power of money or the withholding of money, the power of pressuring the state to act in certain ways, that all of these forms and conduits of civic power are at our disposal once we break out of this frame and this self-fulfilling story of powerlessness. And We're in a moment right now where lots and lots of people around the United States and around the world, left and right, are waking up to this reality.
My guest is Eric Liu. His latest book, You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. In your prologue, you tell a story about something that happened in Immokalee, Florida. What kind of work was involved in that?
Immokalee, Florida is at the epicenter of the great tomato economy, not just of the U.S., but the world. Most of the tomatoes we get at the grocery store or eat at fast food chains have been grown in that part of Florida. And this was a place where most of the picking of most of these tomatoes was done, A, by hand, and B, by the hands of migrant immigrant workers, many of them undocumented, who were for years, for decades actually, laboring under circumstances that essentially you would call indentured servitude, something just a hop and a skip away from slavery, where they were earning pennies on the bucket, not anything close to a minimum wage, where they were subject to incarceration, sexual and other kinds of assault without recourse. And they were essentially a voiceless, powerless body of people. And then starting in the 1990s, after many years of this kind of mistreatment, a few of these tomato pickers of Immokalee, who came mainly from South and Central America, decided to meet in a church. And they decided to say, what could we do actually to reclaim a little bit of our, not just dignity, but our voice and our power? And they began to organize collective action, collective sit-down strikes, collective action to get, you know, initially just simple benefits like a tarp to rest under during break so they wouldn't continue boiling in the sun, and then better wages. And then as they began to apply pressure and began to mobilize more and more of their peers, the growers who were hiring and, in a sense, exploiting these workers realized that the equation had changed, that they couldn't just continually exploit without recourse. And they began to go outside the box of just the fields and the growers. They went to the media. They went to local churches. They began to expand the arena so that more people had to pay more attention. And ultimately, this
group
of
pickers, they got the support of Walmart.
They changed Walmart's policies. They changed Burger King's policies and Taco Bell's policies. And they've created bills of rights for migrant workers in ways that have shifted not just policy, but again, a sense of possibility, right? And when you think about the story of the tomato pickers of Immokalee, and anybody listening to this conversation right now, I just don't care what level of capital you do or don't think you have right now. You have more, almost certainly, than those pickers did in Immokalee. And if they could do it, you can do it. We can do it.
Eric, yesterday we did a segment on what's happening with car parts manufacturing in Alabama, where people are being hurt with and have little protection because the factories are just don't have very many safety features in them, and the owners don't seem to care, and the state doesn't seem to care. So those people aren't organizing. They're just hoping to make the minimum wage, which is around $10 an hour.
At best. And it's a great cover story in the Bloomberg Businessweek magazine you're referring to that describes this form of what, in another context, I've called Confederate capitalism.
But people are not organizing.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that's one of the sad elements of the story, beyond just the actual loss of limb and life that these exploited workers have. But I think the message is, what would begin to happen if a few of them did begin to organize and apply pressure, whether through collective bargaining or through boycotts or through other forms of joint action? They would, again, change the game here. Right now, the game is driven entirely by a chain of people pressuring to drive down costs.
But when the Volkswagen workers had an opportunity to unionize, they voted against it.
Look, I think one of the things that is real in any this is one of the themes actually in the presidential election, too. People ask, why did so many low-income workers vote for Donald Trump when his party's agenda works materially against their interests, right? And I think there's something vaguely condescending in that notion that I know better for you what your interests are, right? It is true that economically, the policies of, say, Donald Trump or the policies of the governments in the South that aid and abet this kind of exploitation are policies that hurt low-income workers. But for all these folks, whether they voted for Trump or whether they're working in a VW factory in Mississippi or Alabama, they've decided to define their self-interest in a different way, through a different story channel, which is about, hey, I'm a person who's working, or hey, I'm a person who's white, or, hey, I'm a person who finds my dignity elsewhere. And if I can find someone else to step on or someone else to make feel worse than me, then that's enough for me, regardless of what my economic interests are in this moment. The job of anybody who wants to reform these situations is not to berate or to condescend and say, you should know better. The job is to activate in them a story that they want to be part of that happens to lead them to the kinds of reform that we think are possible. And that's a story that's been utterly missing in progressive and national politics for a good long time.
I'm talking with Eric Liu, founder and CEO of Citizen University and executive director of the Aspen Institute Citizenship and American Identity Program, author of a number of books, and a former speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton. His latest book, You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. It's published by Public Affairs. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Eric Liu. His latest book, You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen, published by Public Affairs. In your first chapter, One Moment, Our Power, Our Plan, you write that the underlying health of civic life today is poor and that the Trump presidency was born of decades of democratic decline. What are some of the institutions that we need to resuscitate to make us healthy again?
You can almost pick at random any institution in civic life. Congress, we are seeing play out right before our eyes today, is deeply dysfunctional. But state legislatures increasingly are becoming so. They are nationalized and polarized in ways that are making them mini Congresses. But even beyond the legislatures, I think institutions that used to gather people together in this ecosystem of social capital building and civic learning have evaporated. One of the things that our organization, Citizen University, began doing after the election was we started organizing these periodic gatherings called Civic Saturdays, which are essentially a civic analog to church or synagogue or mosque. They're not church or synagogue, but they are about an American civic religion. And they have something of the format of a faith gathering with silent reflection and song and turning to your neighbor and hearing readings of what you might think of as civic scripture. I give a sermon on something in our moment right now and tying it to history. And these Civic Saturdays have just lit people's imaginations up. People are flocking to them. And I think the reason is not just that we put on a good show. The reason is that people are hungry right now because the institutions that used to create this sort of invitation, this permission for people face to face to gather across lines of difference, to come and reckon with one another, and to feel like they have some kind of common fate, even if they don't have all a common agenda, those spaces have shrunken or disappeared in civic life. And so, again, one of the reasons why I think I'm somewhat optimistic about this surge post-inauguration is that all kinds of people in all kinds of settings are following the advice that I write about in my book of Benjamin Franklin, which is start a club, join a club. The simple act of making a club on anything, it doesn't even have to be a political club, right? It can be a book club or a neighborhood group. The simple act of inviting other folks to do something together, to plan that action, to deal with the differences of worldview and point of view that inevitably play out. This is civic muscle building that over the last few decades, most Americans have forgotten how to do.
Why do you think that so much of what we've been seeing, the trends all over the world, has been to the right?
Well, I think to the right is one way to put it. I think
we've seen it in Eastern Europe. We've seen France right now. There's a good chance that Marine Le Pen will either become the next president or will do very well in the election. There's Brexit in England.
We're in a time
in the Netherlands. We're seeing the conservative barely lost.
I wouldn't call it conservative. I would call it radically, radically populist. And the radical populism and the radical nationalism that you're seeing sprout up all over the world right now is a direct and in some ways natural reaction to the ways that over these last few decades, borders have evaporated, right? So that's true in the sense of the economy and globalization. It's true as well in the lines between different groups and statuses that used to be more clearly demarcated, between genders, between races, between different identities. And there is so much more fluidity of identity and opportunity right now And what do you get when you have that kind of fluidity? You get lots of folks who are excited and lots of folks who think this is an opportunity, but you get plenty of folks who find this deeply disorienting, and they want the certainty of authority, they want the certainty of true belief, and they want the certainty of fundamentalism. And we're in an age of identity fundamentalism that is not actually where we're headed. It is just a reaction to the wave of hybridity that the world is actually giving us right now.
One issue that gave Donald Trump some momentum in the election was a backlash to the Black Lives Matter movement. Why did that movement become so powerful that to some it seemed to threaten law and order institutions and people's very way of life?
Yeah, I think you put it quite well, Leonard, actually. How is it that the emergence of a movement which is simply saying, literally in those three words, that lives that hitherto have not been mattering enough in the eyes of the state or in the eyes of non-black citizens should matter, right? If you read into the pregnant pauses between the words Black Lives Matter, what's being said is Black lives should matter. Black lives matter as much. Black lives finally ought to matter, right? And that
But it
message,
wasn't read that way.
It wasn't read that way. And I think the reality of our politics is that lots of folks who are lots of folks who responded negatively to Black Lives Matter set the baseline as, hey, we're in a place where we have all achieved equality. And now here you are doing special pleading and wanting special benefits and wanting special treatment, which is, again, an instantiation of my law number two, which is power justifies itself. Right. When you have white privilege, you tend to see the world as a baseline of, oh, everybody's OK. Now, why are you asking for something special when all that's being asked for is the right to be unarmed, walking down a street, and not to be killed by a member of law enforcement?
And so we started hearing all lives matter and blue lives matter.
Yeah, but I think if all lives mattered, we wouldn't have to say Black Lives Matter. And this is the tug of war. I cite Black Lives Matter actually as a really important movement in our time, not only because it's emblematic of what I think future movements are going to be. It's incredibly decentralized. There are three women who founded the hashtag, but they wouldn't call themselves the central commanders of the movement. It's a decentralized, distributed movement of people who buy into this operating system that says dignity and justice should be available to African Americans. And that leads people wherever they live locally to activate around those principles.
Eric Liu is my guest. His latest book, You Are More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen, published by Public Affairs. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What role does technology play in organizing to affect change? You write that hashtags matter.
Hashtags do matter. I mean, Black Lives Matter being case in point. And there's no question from our president outward, many actors in the civic ecosystem are using social media to grab attention and to grab the power that comes with attention. The thing is, though, if we're going to have a deep bottom-up revival of democratic life, if we're going to actually see this moment of bottom-up power convert itself into something that's healthy and not just a flame-out or not just getting channeled into the kinds of nationalist populism that you're seeing in Europe— what we've got to do is attend to the face-to-face, to the human scale, right? Technology, engaging with other people online, even if it's friendly, much less if it's a flame war, is a poor, poor substitute for that Ben Franklin kind of work of looking somebody in the eye who might be different from you but who shares a community with you and figuring out, what are we going to do to solve this problem together here in Fresno or here in Tulsa or here in Akron?
But so much public discourse today is by tweet.
Yeah. But no one's making us do that. And this is why I think one of the most important arenas for us to feed and see the revival of civic life is the local, right? The more national you go, the more Twitterified things are, right? The more we operate on a Twitter metabolism. But when you're in a neighborhood in Wichita and you're trying to figure out how you're going to create economic opportunity in that neighborhood, if you're in a part of town, if you're in Liberty City, Miami, and you're trying to figure out how different communities are going to build bridges there, you're not going to do this in a Twitter flame war. You're not going to do this via that medium. You're going to do it by knocking on doors, inviting people to church dinners, inviting people to libraries to have conversations about what are our hopes and dreams for this place.
In one of your chapters, the one called Legitimacy and the Power Structure, you begin with the story of 12 American women ranging in age from 23 to 39 who met in 1969. What did those women set out to do?
Those women were deeply dissatisfied with the way that their doctors, the men who were their doctors, were giving them care. And they set out not only to create a document that would exchange tips and strategies for how women patients and women healthcare providers could begin to change the frame and the default settings of medicine, but how more broadly the idea of health itself would not be set to a male default, right? And so
has that changed? Well, aren't we seeing right now legislatures and actually the federal government to some degree seeking to eliminate contraception?
Well, sure. But let me just, I mean, to finish the story of those women in several decades ago, their little pamphlet of ideas stapled and photocopied and passed around became this underground hit, and it became ultimately the mega, mega bestseller, Our Bodies Ourselves, right? Did Our Bodies Ourselves solve women's health inequities and disparities? No. Did Our Bodies Ourselves mean that the fight of ensuring that the healthcare system is respectful of the needs, wants, cares, and peculiarities of a female body compared to a non-female body? No. But it was a giant leap forward in changing the way that people both in and outside the healthcare profession began to think of women, not as a secondary case of patient, but as the other half of humanity that must be tended to with that measure of dignity and respect.
But shouldn't we assume that whenever something like that happens, there's going to be a backlash? And we saw backlash to Our Bodies Ourselves immediately, and now we are seeing all sorts of things that they wanted eroded. So,
yeah, depending on how long,
is it a matter of just who finally has the ultimate power?
Again, I want to emphasize, politics in a democracy is a game of infinite repeat play. There are no permanent victories, right? And so, another way to think about it is, American politics is not about avoiding arguments. America is an argument. We are a perpetual set of tensions and arguments between liberty and equality, between a Hamilton view and a Jefferson view of the size and role of government, between color blindness and color consciousness, right? Between pluribus and unum. I don't want a politics where one side in each of those tensions achieves, quote, final victory. That would be terrible, right? We have to be in a perpetual tension. And as you're in that tug of war, there will be sometimes, and sometimes those times will last decades, where the rope is pulled toward liberty rather than equality. And liberty tells us, you know what, we're going to get government off our backs and we're going to not provide health care for people. People will be free, quote unquote, to take care of themselves. And there will be other times where we'll yank that rope back and say, you know what, health care is a right for all. It's a part of equal dignity in a nation like this. And you have to be engaged in that tug of war perpetually.
You write that, I'm quoting, although I often disagree with him on policy, I've learned a lot from Matt Kibbe, the former Tea Party activist at FreedomWorks and the founder of Free the People. What have you learned?
Boy, Matt and his wife Terry, who founded Free the People, are really interesting community organizers. And in the first place, for as much as that phrase has been vilified by the right when it was attached to President Obama, Matt Kibbe actually proudly takes the label community organizer. He is a libertarian who is not the Ayn Rand toy box libertarian that says, if we can just remove any restriction or encumbrance on me, then everything will be awesome, you know, which I think of as essentially a toddler's libertarianism. Matt Kibbe actually has a view
Does
of libertarian.
Does Paul Ryan know you think that way?
I look
He's
forward
a big
to telling
Ayn Rand
him.
Fan.
I look forward to telling him face to face. But Matt Kibbe understands that liberty is situated in community, right? Now, where he differs from me is that he doesn't want government too involved in community, right? He wants community to be a form of spontaneous order, in the phrase of Hayek. He wants community to evolve from the bottom up as among citizens. And, you know, from that vantage point, there's a lot that he and I can talk about. There's a lot where we can share this common interest in bottom-up citizen self-organizing. We will part ways when it comes to how much the government should be involved in providing a baseline of health security or a baseline of economic security. And he and I can have those arguments and fight those fights about policy and politics. But at the baseline, at the foundation, we share this common interest in bottom-up citizen power. And my view in this book, but my view also in our work at Citizen University, is left, right, or center, if you share that belief in bottom-up citizen power, let's play.
After the election, Ezra Levin, along with some other former congressional aides, published an online guide called Indivisible, a practical guide for resisting the Trump agenda. Were you surprised when it went viral?
I wouldn't have predicted that it would go viral. And I think Ezra and Jeremy and the others who were the co-creators of that document certainly didn't predict it either, to have a 26-page lucid but kind of wonky guide about here's how to apply jujitsu pressure to a member of Congress. Here's how to get their staff to pay attention. Here's how to show up most effectively and so forth. And the way that it went viral online was amazing. But I think even more amazing is that it has spawned over 6,000 now chapters around the country in every congressional district in the country. And that kind of face-to-face organizing is, again, testament to the hunger that people have right now to be part of something greater than themselves that has a civic purpose more than just something for me right now.
Well, at the heart of the Invisible Guide are two main ideas. Presidential power is not unlimited, and Congress responds to pressure when it's applied the right way.
Guess who also subscribed to those two principles? The Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But Indivisible explicitly pays homage to the Tea Party in laying out their guide. The Tea Party emerged in 2010 out of a strong desire to curb presidential and executive overreach and out of a sense that Congress needed to feel the heat.
But in response to similar attempts now and people who are opposed to some of the things that Congress is suggesting at town halls, well, many have canceled their town halls. Some have just suggested that any protesters were paid by George Soros, and some are not answering their phones. So will this have much of an impact?
You know, this is you've heard me use the phrase, the term ecosystem a lot, and I mean that in a very deliberate way. Politics and civic life is a complex adaptive system in which evolution is always happening, right? So if right now members of Congress who are scared to face their own constituents are canceling town halls or shutting off the phone and fax lines, citizens will adapt. And, you know, if I had to place my bets on who will adapt better and faster and with more force, a member of Congress or his 700,000 constituents, I'd place my money on the constituents. So they're going to be able to come up with more collectively creative ways to bypass whatever obstacles a member of Congress throws up to actual engagement.
Eric Liu is the founder and CEO of Citizen University, executive director of the Aspen Institute Citizenship and American Identity Program. He gives frequent TED Talks, which attract millions of views. The author of several books, including A Chinaman's Chance and The Garden of Democracy, which he co-authored with Nick Hanauer. And he has served as a White House speechwriter, policy advisor for President Bill Clinton. His new book is You Are More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. It is from Public Affairs, and it has been my great pleasure to have you on our show again.
Leonard, it's been so wonderful to be in conversation with you.